Hello and welcome to Spirit of Film Conversations. I'm your host, Randall Libero. Movies are changing the way we think, live, and dream. So each week, we interview today's top independent and visionary filmmakers whose movies evoke what I call the spirit of film, which is the movie's magical power to transform our lives. As you just heard me say, the movie's magical power to transform our lives. Now, what makes the movie's magic? How is that created? It comes from the mind and the heart and the soul of the artist. A lot of it is a lot of hard work, a lot of dedication, and some sort of artistic magic. And we have with us today to talk about all those things one of my new friends I've gotten to know recently, Mr. Derek Rydahl. He's an author and a scriptwriter, and his first book was about the aspect of screenwriting. It's called I Could Have Written a Better Movie Than That: How to Make Six Figures as a Script Consultant, Even If You're Not a Screenwriter. And his second book, which is mostly what we're going to be covering today, is called There's No Business Like Soul Business. And you can find out more on the internet about Derek Rydahl at scriptwritercentral.com and enlightenedentertainer.com. Hi, Derek. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, this aspect of the magic of movies, it's a lot of hard work by someone, a lot of dedication, a lot of vision. And so your book, There's No Business Like Soul Business, starts to talk about that aspect of how a film artist or a writer or director or producer gets that vision and keeps that vision. Tell us a little bit about the message of your book.
The message of my book, where it came from, is that I was in the industry as an actor and an up-and-coming actor and then a writer, and I had what amounted to a near-death experience. And I pulled out of the industry and I became sort of a modern-day cloistered monk in my apartment at the time, and was going to become a monk and then a minister. And then I was gifted with a vision of, because I believe that the entertainment industry was kind of a dark and darkened place, and there was, I didn't really, wasn't aware of a higher purpose for it. And then I got this vision of what I believe is the real underlying purpose or potential of entertainment and media, which is to uplift and transform and inspire and educate. And part of it was the realization of where story really originated, and it originated around the tribal fires and with great spiritual leaders and in mythology. And it was primarily to inspire, to educate, to enlighten, or to guide the tribe. And that's really the same exact purpose that it has today. You know, when they gathered around a fire with the light flickering in their eyes as the tribal leaders or shamans, wove stories that helped them to maneuver their life. And nowadays, we gather in these dark caves, so to speak, around this virtual fire, this virtual light that's flickering on the screen. And while the modern day storytellers or shamans are weaving these tales, and they really are equipment for living. They really are metaphors and allegories and analogies that can help us understand our life better, and and evolve as human beings. That's the potential, and there certainly are individuals that are doing that kind of work out there. And so the book was, what I had found in doing my work was that there was a lot of people out there, both aspiring and professional, that were doing this kind of work or that aspired to do this kind of work, but they weren't really connected, and they didn't really know if that feeling they had, that there was something to this, was real, or if it was just imaginary and nobody really was interested in this kind of work. And so I wrote the book to begin to start a conversation and a dialogue to connect people of like mind that really are here to tell stories and create movies and media that inspire and uplift and educate and guide. And that's really what the book is. And it starts off really establishing that idea and that vision, but then the book also is a supportive manual for artists and entertainment and media professionals who are trying to navigate the entertainment industry and, get a piece of the act without losing their piece in the act. Or, like I say, try to sell themselves without selling their soul and create work that matters and that has meaning, but that is also mainstream. So that was sort of my intention with you know, writing that book and with some of the teaching and the coaching that I do.
If you consider the idea of mythology as someone's life and the hero's journey, and actually being in the movie business is really a pretty serious and intense hero's journey. Because,
Absolutely. Because
why would anyone want to, what motivates someone to make a film, to have to go through the technical and the artistic learning curve, work with a lot of people, deal with the egos in the business, deal with the industry aspects, deal with the technical aspects, all the artistic stuff, coordinating people. I mean, just to make a film, even a simple film, even in this digital age,
right,
is a tremendous amount of work. So you wonder, what drives people to do this? I mean, I worked in Hollywood for 12 years. I lived in Los Angeles. And afterwards, I came to the realization that I got to get out of here. This is crazy.
Right.
So what makes someone want to be in a business like this?
I think it is very, you could definitely draw parallels. I mean, certainly there are people that are in it just for the money and the lottery mentality and thinking that they're going to whip out a script over the weekend and make $1 million, that kind of thing. But I think primarily you can draw parallels to the religious life, you know, to the calling, you know, a person who's called into some sort of great work in the world, spiritually or religiously or whatever, and sometimes against their better judgment, you know, or against their will, they just are called, they have a vision of something, and they can't help it. And I think you can definitely make parallels to that, to artists and to entertainment professionals. They are captured by a vision. And it may not always be a vision like that they can see clearly, but it might be an internal feeling, but they are pulled by something that is, you know, despite the pain and the suffering that sometimes goes with this path, despite the challenges and the hurdles and all that you just mentioned, they can't help themselves because they're pulled by something. And even the ones that ultimately say, forget it, I can't handle it, it's like the hero's journey. There is the call, and there is sometimes the refusal of the call. And then eventually the answering of the call, and that, you know, takes us into the second act of the hero's journey. And there are definitely some artists and entertainment professionals that have had the call, that have tried it, that have felt bruised or burnt out or you know, broken by it, and have ultimately refused the call. And in some cases, you know, those people you meet that are very bitter and cynical, because they're not following that calling because of the pain they experienced in the industry. And that was one of the reasons why I wrote the book also, was that I met a lot of people who were truly gifted and truly insightful and truly were called. But they experienced so much pain in trying to, you know, actualize that calling. And one of the biggest problems was all of the limited beliefs and perspectives and ideas about the business and about the path of the business that was, you know, exacerbating the pain and creating more suffering and really creating so many blocks to their fulfillment. And so I wrote the book as an opportunity to support individuals in beginning to dissolve and eliminate some of those mostly internal blocks to finding that, you know, deeper creativity and that greater purpose and the courage and the strength and the fortitude to move forward with their vision, despite what sometimes seems like insurmountable obstacles in the business. So I think that, you know, it really is a calling, and that's what drives people to do it. And even if the surface mind sometimes thinks, I want the fame and the fortune, if you scratch that deeper, there is something more than that that's calling them. Because really, if it was just fame or fortune, there's so many easier ways to get that. You know, you can definitely find ways to get your 15 minutes of fame or make money. You know, so that's certainly, that they may think that's what's driving them, but in so many cases, it's really this deeper calling. And I think it's because, again, as I say in the beginning of my book, and I talk about the parable, you know, of the storyteller, that I think, there really is that parallel to that sort of mystical or shamanic journey. And I think the more we realize that, and the more we embrace that, and the more we infuse our stories with that energy, whatever the genre, that the more, not only the more successful individuals will become, but also the more the industry will actualize its potential as being an instrument of wisdom and transformation and light on the planet, which we definitely are. There's a call for that right now more than ever. So that's been my insight into the experience.
In the chapter headings of your book, you've got some great chapter headings, which is about the artist's path and building business relationships and the business of show and the aspect of becoming an enlightened entertainer. And that's your website, enlightenedentertainer.com. What do you think is transforming in the film industry right now? Do you see what I would call some sort of a movement happening for people that are waking up in Hollywood? Because I look at it as sort of, you know, we're all human beings and consciousness is evolving. We're seeing this happening every day in so many different aspects. And you can't leave out the movie industry. I mean, there's still people who are running the movie industry. So it's got to have some sort of an effect on what's happening in the film industry. What's your take on that?
I think absolutely there is. I mean, yeah, there is. The vibration of the planet is speeding up. Things are happening quicker and quicker, and there is an evolutionary process going on right now that's being accelerated in general. And so, yes, it's going to affect the entertainment industry. And like I've said before, I believe that the real underlying idea behind storytelling and the entertainment industry is the same idea that was behind the great parables of religious teachers and the great mythologies and you know, the great shamans around the tribal fires when they told their stories, which is its purpose is to enlighten, inspire, educate, and guide. And we get distracted by the word entertainment, but if you break the word entertainment down, it has two meanings. One is to divert the senses, and the other one is to contemplate or consider an idea. And when you put them together, the very mechanism of entertainment is about diverting the senses and almost putting it into a state of hypnosis so that this idea is held up for deeper contemplation or consideration, whatever the idea of the story is. And when you are able to divert the senses sufficiently through the entertainment value, that idea that you are trying to, you know, express goes directly into the heart and the mind and the unconscious of the individual and is not blocked or monitored by the monitoring part of the mind. So, you know, we see it in commercials all the time. So entertainment is a very powerful mechanism of transformation and education and all that. And so I believe that's really the purpose of the entertainment industry. And I think there are many people out there that you can see that are flashes of light, that are doing this kind of work. And, you know, you see Jim Carrey, and you see Brian Grazer, and Ron Howard, and some of Spielberg's stuff, and you see Oprah, and, you know, there's people, and George Clooney, that are trying to do this kind of stuff. And so that's definitely happening, you know. But I think as individuals, we cannot wait for the world to conform to us or to our vision. We have to have the courage to tap into a deeper vision and the true value systems within us, and then be willing to stand up and stand for that and be precedent setters and visionaries in our own right. You know, there's a great scriptural saying that says, "Be ye not conformed to the world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind." And so what we've come to bring here as individuals has never happened before. This is true for everybody. You know, we are unique expressions of life that have never happened. And when we have the courage to be that as artists, as entertainment professionals, etc., then we become precedent centers. And we literally bring into expression the new wave, the new evolutionary paradigm, or what I call the emerging edge. And so you know, you don't even have to look at the industry and ask, well, is this the trend, or is this what people are doing, or, you know, will I fit in somewhere? You have to look within yourself and say, what am I really here for? What is really truly the vision of my heart and soul, regardless of what's going on out there? I have to be congruent to that. I have to be in integrity with that. And then, you know, in my book I talk about certain tools and things like that that allow you to be not just in integrity with that, but then to have the fortitude and the consciousness to be successful at it, you know, to not live the starving artist life, you know, but to go from merely surviving to actually thriving in this business and as an artist or an entertainment professional.
Well, I brought along some books today of some of my favorite filmmakers, Stanley Kramer and Akira Kurosawa. There's also a few quotes on my website. About a year and a half ago, I interviewed Michael Phillips, who was the producer of The Last Mimsy, Oscar-winning producer for Close Encounters and The Sting and many other films. And on that film, I put two comments from both the screenwriter, Bruce Joel Rubin, and, and the director, Bob Shea. And I really like what Bruce Joel Rubin said about his approach to summing up the screenplay. He said, "This was a movie that I wanted to be about the exploration and discovery of a purity in the human spirit that is something people can look at and touch and watch as it moves through time and space. It is something that is worth preserving. I thought this movie would be a wonderful vehicle for a metaphysical, spiritual, and fable-like mythic story. It has all those possibilities in it. It's such a simple tale, but it goes deep. I only want to write movies that have some reason for being in our culture. Most of the stories out there just take your mind away for 2 hours and give nothing back. I don't want to tell those stories. I want a movie where you get something that lingers, that embeds itself inside you and changes you a little bit. I think The Last Mimsy is that story." So that is one of the things that I see happening, especially from the writer's perspective, that we're starting to see these little pieces in movies that have always been there since their beginning. Even in the silent era, there were films that had this power of what I call the magical power of the spirit of film, which is what I built the show around. And from this idea, I started seeing that there's something much larger happening, what we've been talking about. In your book, you call it conscious entertainment. I wrote an article in 1989, which was published, which I call it The Inner Eye of Movies. And then sort of, you know, I've been kind of exploring this for a long time. And I read film reviewers like Parker Tyler and James Agee and what they wrote about what was going on during the 1940s and 50s. And out of those studies, I started seeing that, just like you, Derek, there's something else that's happening, that's sort of this underlying energy or wave that's transforming all of us, and of course transform the entertainment business. And that's why I came up with the term visionary entertainment, which is to indicate what I feel is a major shift in motion pictures and media, because you got to put all the media in there now that we got the internet and cell phones and everything else.
Right.
Because movies have evolved technologically, beginning with silence and sound films, TV stereo sound, computerized special effects. Of course, now we have the internet streaming video. But in their historical evolution, movies have changed in many ways. First, in the specific themes they explored, the personal, social, and spiritual. Secondly, in the way stories were told cinematically, which is the visual language of the film. And third, of course, the technological advances in the medium. And fourth, in the way that people actually viewed and consumed them from a business perspective. So this convergence of storytelling and technological developments and art and the human spirit and these new methods of distribution all together is what I call visionary entertainment. It's sort of this conglomerate of things that are going on at the same time.
Right.
From your talking with people in the motion picture industry, do you get a sense that they see that there is something happening which has never happened before in the entertainment business that is not only just affecting us in the artistic form of film, but the way that people are responding to movies, what audiences are sensing?
Well, there's definitely something happening. There's an evolution. There's definitely a technological, distributional evolution going on in this, in the way that people get their entertainment and experience entertainment, you know, with the advent of the internet and the ubiquity of high-speed, you know, broadband and all of that, and the YouTube phenomenon of short video things, and now webisodes, and, you know, getting them on your iPhone or your PDA or your cell phone or whatever. There is what's happening from a technological standpoint, and there's this book out there called The Long Tail, T-A-I-L, which describes this, is that it used to be we lived in a culture that was about, it was a hit culture, HIT, where everything was geared around creating movies, music, TV shows that could appeal to the largest common denominator, which then homogenized them to quite a great degree, and in many cases made them much more, you know, had the tendency to be more superficial or shallow because they had to appeal to everybody. because there was limited shelf space. There was limited shelf space on the bookshelf, on the record shelf, on the network lineup shelf, and in the movie house itself. With the advent of the internet and all these digital technologies, we moved from a hit culture to a niche culture, N-I-C-H-E, meaning that instead of creating one product for millions, we now have the capability to create millions of products for the one. And so that we are now creating our own jukeboxes on our iPods rather than having to depend on what they put on the radio. We're creating our own network lineup with TiVo rather than it, and also with the internet, rather than having to depend on what they put on their limited network, and on and on and on. So it's becoming, as it becomes more and more individualized like that, and as the technology for making films and making, you know, entertainment becomes so easy for the average person to create something of, you know, with a production value, then it's opening up the doors for the kinds of, you know, variety and diversity of thinking and entertainment type products that we can create as artists and entertainment professionals, and the kinds that we can, you know, consume as the consumers of them. So that landscape is like, it's like the Wild West right now. And, you know, of course, YouTube has opened that up. But, you know, on YouTube now, people create their own channels, and people, you know, my son was one of them who had millions of views on the videos he was creating. And so now YouTube is literally creating like little mini networks where people are getting paid based on how many people view their videos. And some of these people now who you've never heard of yet are getting millions and millions of viewings. They're getting viewings equal to, you know, some cable network shows. And so now they're building these little cottage networks, you know, around that. Now, they may not be conscious or visionary, but for those individuals like us that are about more conscious or visionary entertainment, it opens up yet one more great possibility to begin to create and produce and distribute our work. And the entertainment industry is absolutely aware of this, and in some cases afraid of it, because it's moving the power center from the studio to the individual. You know what I mean? Because now you and I can create our own virtual studio.
Everybody's becoming a filmmaker.
Yeah, everybody's becoming a filmmaker
like
or a
kids
movie
grab
mobile.
A camera and there you go.
Exactly. You have a camera, you have a Final Cut or something on your computer, and you have a you set up your site on on YouTube or something like that, and you are a mini mogul in the making.
So the internet sort of has these two different aspects to it. It's a way where we're focused on the screen and we're looking at the reality of what we see on the internet, and we're forming our opinions based on little tiny little bits and pieces of information, a YouTube video here, a news story there, an email here. And I find that it's not just that people are getting a camera and making some films and putting them up on YouTube. It's this whole phenomenon of how we're relating to each other. How are we talking to each other? We're losing that human connection. And that's what The Last Mimsy was about, is that there's a price for that. It's the price of our humanity. When I talk to guys who are making films, or, you know, my friends, or even people, you know, I see these kids in school who've got a camera. I mean, my son was hanging out with a friend of his who's 8 or 9 years old, and they're making little videos and they're learning how to do special effects and stuff. And I'm looking at these kids, I'm going, well, what are you going to do with that? In my opinion, the artist has a responsibility to communicate a message of what spiritual truth is through their art. I mean, that's what all the great filmmakers have talked about, how to make a difference. I wanted to read something talking about old Hollywood, because when filmmakers wanted to make a film before, in maybe the 30s and 40s and 50s or 60s, what that was called was a message movie. Your film has a message. It was looked down upon in the industry.
Right. If you want to send a message, use Western
Union. Use Western Union, exactly. Famous quote by, I don't know, some studio head, I forget. Right. So what I wanted to do is read just a brief little piece here from Stanley Kramer's biography by Donald Spoto, Stanley Kramer, filmmaker, what he talks about the idea of message movies from his perspective. He says, I was brought into the film world in the era of Franklin Roosevelt, an era noted for the liberal approach, quote unquote. That's the one that promised a good deal and didn't deliver it. I have been the flag bearer of that viewpoint and therefore somewhat attacked along the way for being part of a do-good era. But I never started off a film with a message. If to make a film contemporary and provocative, if to make film drama out of what is already drama, is to communicate a message, then I am guilty. I think everything has a message. I don't care what it is. Some critics and theater operators have stuck me with the label message filmmaker, but in fact I see myself as a storyteller with a point of view. Maybe I'm out of step with the times because a lot of movies are made today with no statement at all, just shock and sensation or a motivationless kind of approach to a story, a senseless crime, a pointless love affair. That's all right for those who want to do it, but personally I don't find it particularly compelling. Like lots of kids in the 1930s, I wanted to right all the wrongs of mankind. But quite aside from the rhetoric of politics, what grabs me in cinematic terms is the idea of telling a story against the background of social or political conflict. I'm not interested in changing anyone's opinion, just in telling a story. So that was the point of view from Stanley Kramer, who's made Inherit the Wind and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And, you know, I've seen pretty much all his movies, On the Beach, which is one of my favorites. And you can have a message in a film and tell it well by getting the audience involved, an approach that I think still scares Hollywood to a greater or lesser extent. So what we find today is films that have this message of what you call maybe enlightenment or, you know, visionary ideas that are sort of woven into the story in these mythological concepts. Star Wars was a very good example of that. Do you think that audiences are becoming more acceptable to this kind of filmmaking? Do they look for it? Because the popularity of films like What the Bleep and The Secret, I think, is sending a message to Hollywood and to independent film industry in particular that there's a demand for this now. Stephen Simon established a spiritual cinema circle, and so people subscribe to actually pay every month to get these kinds of films. Now, I see that as that's a trend. Do you think that there's definitely the audience is wanting these kinds of films?
I think there's two things going on here, and this is a very rich topic, you know, which I've talked about with, you know, writers and filmmakers, and there's two trends. There is, on one hand, the documentary trend is one thing, and that's things that have made, given more street cred and commercial credibility to films like, you know, Fahrenheit 9/11 and 9/11 and The Secret and What the Bleep and, you know, different. Bill Maher's got one coming out, Religious, and, you know, this idea that a documentary where you explore provocative ideas is now becoming more mainstream. That's a really, really good thing. And then there is this idea of spiritual cinema or enlightened entertainment or conscious media or whatever. And I think the danger with that, I've always had a challenge with calling it spiritual cinema or even enlightened entertainment, because these are words that make you think of it's going to be just talking about spirituality or God or preachiness and didacticism and all of those kind of things that actually turn even me away. And I'm a person who is deeply, deeply devoted to things spiritual. But I think we have to be very careful in that, like Stanley Kramer talked about, you didn't necessarily start off trying to tell a message. He wanted to tell a compelling story that was moving to him, meaningful to him, and inherent in doing that, there's always a message. And it's everything. Every story is telling something, saying something. It just may or may not be conscious from the creator. But so you got to be careful that, you know, in a lot of the scripts I've read and even many of the films, smaller films I've seen, where people are trying to be spiritual or conscious, they tend to feel kind of preachy or kind of new agey or kind of, lightweight, for lack of a better word, you know, this kind of Village of the Happy People kind of thing. Oftentimes the scripts that I read lack real conflict or real drama. Whereas instead of understanding that making a conscious film that has an impact, that is inspiring or transforming or whatever, first must start with telling a great story. And the principles of great storytelling and drama still apply. And then ultimately your story can only really be as enlightened and as meaningful as you are as a human being. As an actor, my acting teacher used to always say, every time you get up on the stage, the only thing you can ever bring to a part is who you are. And so, you know, if you are a person who's, you know, caught up in a lot of fear or judgment or whatever, and you think you're going to go out and make a conscious film, you're probably not going to. You may put some of those words in the film, but it's not going to have that resonance. So I think that's really important to understand that we still have to tell great stories. And when I'm coaching a writer, I always start with the story. You know, let's just talk about a great story, a story that you care about, that you're passionate about. And then let's go back and begin to discover what is the deeper meaning that is trying to be conveyed here. Then we can bring those clues more to the surface so that that story becomes, you know, clear and cohesive and is delivering a very specific idea or message. But by starting with the story is what's going to drive it. And, you know, it's like the spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. If you're trying to write quote-unquote spiritual or enlightened films, and you're just doing that in a bald fashion, it's kind of like trying to give people medicine without the sugar, and they're going to spit it out. But on the other hand, if you just write films that are all, you know, entertainment and FX, and there's no conscious intent beneath them, it's like giving people sugar pills. And so I think it's really important, you know, this is a much bigger conversation, but I think it's really important for people who want to write these kind of movies or create this kind of content that they don't, you know, they understand that you have to still tell great and compelling stories that are entertaining and involving and all that. And you just have to tell ones that you care about. And if you do that, then they're going to deliver some kind of value to the people that view them.
Yeah, and that brings to mind, talk about writing a little bit.
Sure.
The idea of, and you bring it up on page 33 in your book, I Could Have Written a Better Movie Than That, about the idea of character versus plot driven. And there's a lot of screenwriters and guys who teach screenwriting today, and it's all about structure and how the story moves along and everything like that. But really, it comes down to, I think, from hearing how people are transformed by the movies that they see, it really comes through identifying with the character and his story or her story or a group of people or their story or what happened to them, how they beat the odds, how they overcame something that was dangerous or how they cheated death or how they got out of a jam or whatever. That's what people really want to see because that's what they take away. I was in a conference recently in San Francisco where we talked about what movies changed us and why and what stayed with us afterwards. And it could have been something as simple as like Superman and that we all have superpowers. And what do you do with those? You're a great visionary, you're a great networker, or you're a great communicator, or you're an amazing speaker, or whatever. We all have these amazing spiritual superpowers, and you can look at it that way. And so movies help to awaken people, and that's why the great films are about these much bigger themes. And films that they're not looking to have a message. I mean, you look at a film like The Wizard of Oz or even Citizen Kane. There's some powerful messages in there, but the story is very dramatic. And what drives the story is all about what happens to the characters.
Well, I think here's again, you know, the challenge is, it's funny because it, in a way, it's kind of like, you know, the partisanship in Washington. You know, there's the Democratic liberal side and there's the conservative Republican side, and then there's the polarization that has gotten obviously more and more intense. But when you look beneath the surface of the content of the conversations to the deeper principles, you discover that really the conservative Republican and the Democratic liberal are two aspects or dimensions of a bigger whole. And likewise, and if people could get to that discussion and conversation, we could solve some of our bigger story issues in the story of our human experience. But likewise, in the screenwriting and storytelling debate, they are all, it's the same. And there's this polarization between character and story or plot versus character. And it's really kind of the wrong debate because they are two absolutely equally necessary dimensions of good story. And ultimately, they aren't even separate. You know, it's like in quantum physics, we used to think that there was a wave and that there was a particle. And now we understand that the particle is the wave in particle form, and the wave is the particle in wave form. It's like we used to think there was a mind and a body, but now we understand that the body is the mind in form and the mind is the body in fluidity. Well, likewise, the character, there is not a character and a plot. The character is the plot in the particle form, in the individualized form, and the plot is the character in the wave form. They are one and the same. And you can't have a character without a plot. Otherwise, it's just a vacuum. It's got no relationship. And you can't truly have plot or story without some form of character. They require the two dimensions of this larger gestalt called story. Does that make sense?
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. But the other aspect of when we're watching something is, and you mentioned this before, that it was the way we see films today are that there's these flickering images of light. And in ancient times, it used to be around the campfire, and today it's the movie. And the cinematic experience today is, as you say, you know, it's hypnotizing. I look at it as from the aspect of while you're watching a movie, think about it. You're actually in an altered state of consciousness. Have you ever watched a film that you've got so focused on it that you the world around you, sitting in your living room or you're in a movie theater, and you forget about everything else that's going on in your life?
Totally.
You're actually in a deep meditation or shamanic journeying, if anybody's done that. You're actually in a state of sort of hyper-reality. But in that hyper-reality, that's where deeper understanding and greater awakening may occur.
Right.
So the motion picture has allowed our modern global society to become much more familiar with moving into states of expanded awareness and to have that experience in a shared environment where the effects of transformational energy grow exponentially. And that's why I think much of the movie-going experience is what each of us brings to the film personally, as well as the film artist's intent. And that frame of reference colors our interpretation of the film's literal story and its image story. And I see those as two things. There's a literal story, which is what we're seeing, what happens to the character.
Right.
And there's an image story. And that's how I describe this experience of viewing a film where we're in the state of hyper-reality. So as I said, for the past 100 years, people have been indoctrinated into understanding how having these experience when they're watching something, their mind is going in and out of the shift of energy where they're having this experience of this hyper-reality. Now, in historical periods, that was done through ceremony, that was done through social communities and religious teachings, but today we have the media, and the media is doing it. I just find that fascinating.
Some in the media understand that that's what they're doing, and they use that, unfortunately, in a not in a destructive way. You know, the mass marketing machine of media and commercials and all that is using that hypnotic process, you know, to literally brainwash us into believing that if we don't have that particular product, we are going to be less worthy, less whole, less happy, etc. So,
and much more nefarious things. I mean, if you go back and look at films, I always bring up, everybody seems to forget about this, but when I remind them, they kind of remember that Leni Riefenstahl, when she made Triumph of the Wolf for Adolf Hitler, which galvanized an entire country into a war machine.
Right.
I mean, that was a very, very powerful movie. If you have the guts to sit through that film and watch that,
right,
you'll understand it. Here's another good example. If you think there's extraterrestrial life out there, if you believe that that's a reality, then why during the 1950s were there so many films about aliens are attacking us and evil aliens and, you know, It, the Terror from Beyond Space and all this other stuff going on? Was there a campaign to make us afraid of having contact with beings from other worlds? So
that, or they could have been metaphorical for our fear of, you know,
communism at the time.
Communism, the Germans, the Russians, whatever. I mean, my uncle directed the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And that was very much a commentary on, you know, communism and all that. I know for a fact. So sometimes they are using that as a metaphor to tap into our current fears. And, you know, to have a conversation about social topical issues in a way that's not overt or on the nose, as it were. that's one of the good uses of science fiction, is that we can have a discussion, dramatic discussion, about very pertinent social issues without it becoming didactic or on the nose or overt, but yet you still know that's what it's about, you know what I mean? And it becomes very powerful then.
Yeah, very much so. And even, of course, we look at the aspect of news. I mean, if you sit and watch your local news for a little while and really look at what you're being told, and I when I do some speaking engagements, I talk to people about doing this, is to step back from whatever screen that you're looking at, whether it's on your cell phone or the movie theater or in your home, you're watching a DVD or you're watching the news, is remember, do whatever you have to do. You know, what I do is I hold the index finger of my left hand. I sit there holding it. So I'm doing something physically. So I know that I'm applying pressure, and it's like a little reminder. And I'll sit there, my hands in my lap, and I'll squeeze my finger. And okay, that reminds me that, you know, to take my brain off of the screen. We need to keep ourselves present, and there's so many teachings today about how to do that. So when I really implore people, when you go to the theater or you're at home watching a DVD, remember that there's human beings around you. There's, you know, your family or your friends, or even if you're watching a movie by yourself, like late at night, as many people do, is to keep that aspect of humanness about you. Keep your presence. Don't allow yourself to get sucked into a world that's not your own. I mean, that's how I put it to people.
Yeah, I think that's very, very important. When especially you're watching the news, I suggest people don't, you know, sit and watch the news too often, or listen to the all this stuff, except specifically in specific moments and with a specific intention that you set before you watch it, so that you are telling the mind what to look for to gather specific information that can be valuable and useful in your life, as opposed to just being hypnotized and brainwashed and imprinting these negative images and ideas that ultimately cause you to feel like the world is imploding and life is terrible and you're going to die. You know?
Right.
It's a very stress-inducing experience. And the same thing with a movie, you know, with movies and all that. I'm developing another project that is about, you know, teaching people how to watch and experience movies and media in a way that can bring it back to what its original purpose is, which is, you know, to be an instrument of inspiration, transformation, education, catharsis, etc. And even if the author or the creator hasn't intentionally created something for that purpose, then you as the viewer can bring that conscious intention to it. And when you do that, you discover that everything, every story on the big and the little screen becomes an opportunity for insight and wisdom and growth, even if the creator did not have that intention. And even if the creator had the opposite, nefarious intention, if you bring that conscious intention to it, everything becomes a learning experience, because ultimately all of life and the whole life story is a Rorschach test. And as you mentioned before, you know, we bring so much to the story. And if we are conscious of what we're bringing to the story, we get a picture of who we are and where we are living. As Shakespeare said to the players in Hamlet, you know, it is our job to hold up a mirror to society and to humanity in order that they may see themselves. So we can hold up that mirror to ourselves by knowing that all of life is a mirror, and that the meaning we're assigning to the movie or the media tells us more about ourselves than it does about the actual piece of media.
I just want to read from page 233 of your book, There's No Business Like Soul Business, because I think you wrapped it up really, really well on that page.
233?
Yeah, you say, if you want to read the last part, you say, well, we're at a crossroads.
It's funny, because I was also going to read the with State of the Heart Entertainment, which is on the page before that.
Right, okay.
That page.
Well, just go ahead and read those parts, because, I mean, I really, when I read those parts, I had so much hope, and I had so much, I just felt really good.
Yeah, well, sure. and it starts with a quote. 50 years from now, we're going to be inside the movies, Steven Spielberg said. We're not going to be looking at them from the outside. A good movie will bring you inside of itself just by the sheer brilliance of the director, writer, production staff. But in the future, you will physically be inside the experience, which will surround you top, bottom, on all sides. End quote. And I say, I believe he's right in terms of the technical evolution that entertainment will undergo. But I believe there's another evolution, or revolution, in the works. A revolution of meaning. As we grow into a more conscious community of artists and entertainment professionals, we will not only create the possibility for the audience to be inside the entertainment experience, we will create an entertainment experience that lives inside the audience and transforms them from the inside out. In the near future, we will live in an entertainment culture. Almost everything we do or see will be packaged with entertainment value. You won't just go shopping, you'll have an entertainment experience as you buy body scrub. You won't just watch TV, you'll interact with the programming and buy things you see on screen. You won't check into hotels, you'll check into theme parks with rooms. You won't have separate computers, TVs, phones, or MP3 players. You'll have all-in-one devices that allow you to listen to music, watch film and TV, surf the net, chat with friends, and check your bodily vitals. We will be a completely wired world, all geared toward entertaining us. Entertaining us to death, some might say. If not literally, then mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. As the Pink Floyd song says, we will become comfortably numb. At least that's one possible outcome. State-of-the-art advances in media and communication will make this future a physical inevitability. But its mental, emotional, and spiritual impact are still very much in our hands. We can create a media machine of mass distraction, or one that provides mystical direction. We can create entertainment that anesthetizes us into unconsciousness or wakes us up. We can live in an ever-increasing high-tech, low-touch society, or use technology and media to bring us into a more intimate relationship with ourselves, each other, and life itself. The wired world has given us a global brain. Enlightened entertainment can connect us to a global heart, and yes, even our soul. Remember, the word entertain contains two seemingly contradictory meanings: to divert or amuse, and to contemplate or hold attention. Radical moralists and religious fundamentalists might say we should get rid of the amusement park and pound people into submission with a lesson, while bottom-line business minds shake their heads at our hearts and tell us to call Western Union if we want to send a message. I don't believe it has to be an either-or decision. In fact, the true fulfillment of entertainment, by its very definition, requires that we embrace both aspects of it. We need the medicine to heal us, but the sugar sure helps it go down. Without sugar, the medicine is bitter and we'll do anything to avoid it. But without medicine, all we're eating are sugar pills. Besides making us spiritual diabetics with fat egos, all that sugar will eventually taste as bitter. We're at a crossroads, a choice point, a tipping point. We can choose to ignore the mystical dimension of media, or put this awesome, ever-evolving entertainment industry back in the service of the soul. That choice, I believe, will determine a great extent whether we become more self-actualized and awakened with every click of the mouse, jab of the joystick, frame of film, channel surfed, and song downloaded, or if we become lulled into an ever deeper slumber of ignorance, fear, and separation.
No, I think you just summed that up really, really well in that those last few pages. Well, Derek, thanks so much for being with us today. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
It's my pleasure.
If you want to find out more about Derek's work, he's a professional actor, screenwriter, singer-songwriter, and author, and a licensed spiritual therapist and founder of EnlightenedEntertainer.com and ScriptWriterCentral.com, which is one of the fastest-growing online firms for screenwriting and script consulting services. Derek has coached thousands of artists, professionals, and individuals from many walks of life, including Fortune 500 companies, helping them uncover their creative potential, find their authentic voice, live a more prosperous life, and fulfill their higher purpose. That's a wrap for our show for this week. Join us again next week as we showcase the very best in movie entertainment that inspires us towards positive change and honors the belief that simple choices can change the world. I'd like to thank Tom Kirsch and the rest of the Catfish Groove Farm Band for our theme music, and you can hear more of their really cool tunes at catfishgroovefarm.com. You can find out more on the internet about Spirit of Film Conversations and the movies and people we talk to each week by going to my website at spiritoffilm.net. And please tell your friends about where to find our program right here on 7thWaveNetwork.com. And remember, you are the writer, producer, director, and star of your own movie that's called Your Life. So make it a blockbuster, and it'll be a classic. Until next time, I'm Randall Abaro for Spirit of Film Conversations. We'll see you next week.